talking to me?
Funny, like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead, make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. Today is April 24th, and this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Kate Marquis.
Kate Marquis is here. Kate reviews movies for We Are Movie Geeks and The Jewish Light. What have you reviewed for The Jewish Light lately, Kate?
Oh, let's see. The last thing I reviewed for them was a wonderful documentary from Israel that they finally decided not to open in St. Louis, which was so disappointing.
I was going to ask you about
I really enjoyed it.
They pulled it at the last days to go, didn't they?
Well, yeah, I hope you still got paid.
I did, actually.
Well, good.
So, but in search of Israeli cuisine, if you can look it up online, I actually found it was fascinating. I'm so sorry they didn't run that.
Well, we'll have to do something with your review.
Yes, my goodness.
Went to the trouble of writing it. Did we post a review at our site about that?
Well, no, since you were reviewing it for Jewish Light, you couldn't review it for us, could you?
Why don't you just put your review at our site?
Maybe I'll do that.
Yeah, you should.
Oh, so
to check with them. Since they didn't run it, they should be okay.
Right. Okay. Well, we're glad you're here. And first, let's talk about the top 12 of the box office. Last week, we called into Michelle. Did you listen to last week's podcast, Kate?
No, I didn't.
Michelle, who got married and is going to change her name.
Something like that.
But we can't call Michelle because she's at work, so I'm going to have to do this top 12 by myself. Let's start with number 12. Get Out is still in the top 12. Good for that.
Yes.
$1.7 million. Phoenix Forgotten. I saw Phoenix Forgotten Friday night. It did not crack the top 10. It was number 11 with $2.0 million.
Hmm.
It opened pretty wide, so that's not very good.
Yeah, at least 1,000 screens.
Lost City of Z, which you guys reviewed last week and didn't care for, was number 10 with 2.1. The Promise, which we're going to review here in a few minutes, 4.1. That was number 9. 8 was Gifted, $4.5 million. 7 was Unforgettable, which Jim went out and saw. We're going to review that here in a few minutes. That opened pretty wide and made $4.8 million. Smurfs Lost Village made $4.8 million. Going in Style, still in the top 5. I watched the old Going in Style. I tracked it down on it was on Vudu the other night.
Yeah.
It was interesting. That made $5.0 million. Good for number 5. Born in China is one of these Disney documentaries. Jim saw that. He's going to review it here in a minute. That made $5.1. Good for number 4. Beauty and the Beast. Hanging in there, $10 million for number 3. Boss Baby, $12.8 million for number 2. And number 1 for the second week in a row was Fate of the Furious. Fate of the Furious opened with, I think, $102 million, and in its second weekend it made $38.7 million.
Prediction that it will be number 1 again this weekend, but that's his last one because Marvel's coming for you, buddy.
Yeah. Galaxies of the Guardians opens a week from Friday. I think I mispronounced
that. Yes, Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2.
Okay, Volume 2. All right, well, we got a bunch of movies to review. We have 8 movies to review. Oh my gosh, we're so busy.
Oh, my goodness.
And you'd think we missed last week, but we didn't miss last week. So we just saw a lot of stuff, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of screenings last week. Very few this week.
All right, Jim.
Yes.
This Born in China movie, which came in number 4 at the box office, what the heck is that about?
This film, I think, is groundbreaking in the sense that it really gives the audience a view into China that we don't see. What's really magnificent about the footage is how incredibly difficult it is to get that footage.
Oh, that is, as you might suspect, it's all set in China. It's another entry in the Disney Nature series. I mentioned in my review that Disney cracked up a lot of Oscars in the 50s with their True Life Adventures short subjects, and these are kind of expanded now into a feature film, and they've been doing these for about 10 years or so, and usually they'll have a big star or medium-sized star narrating it.
Morgan Freeman?
Like Morgan Freeman did with the Penguins, but the last couple of I saw Chimpanzees that had Tim Allen. The last one that was out was Monkey Kingdom with Tina Fey. This time it's John Krasinski from The Office and with the 13 Hours of Benghazi and The Hollers. He's guiding
Leatherheads.
Yeah, that's right. he's guiding us through the wilds of China, and there's a lot of wild country in there. It's basically focusing on, it could be almost like three shorts from the 50s hooked together, because it's three separate stories, really, sort of spread out over the spring and summer and the fall seasons. There's a family of snow leopards led by a female named Dawa, who are trying to exist in the highlands, climbing the rocks and all that. And she's got two female cubs, and they're having to deal not only with the scarcity of food, but another group of snow leopards sort of intruding on their territory. There's Tay-Tay, the teenage snub-nosed golden monkey, and he's in the forest, and he's having a tough time because his family has a new baby. He's got a new baby sister. All the attention's on her, so he goes in with these, they call them the Wild Boys, or the Lost Boys, I guess, from Peter Pan, and they're just a bunch of hell-raising monkeys. And it's a really, really interesting story there. But everyone is going to come to see the film because of the pandas. Everybody loves the pandas. And we do have a giant panda in this one named Yaya. And it's about her raising her adorable little cub, Mai Mai. And,
who names these critters? Yaya and Tay-Tay and Mai Mai?
Well, they're all like, you know, Chinese, flavored. And I'm sure that the writers of the film, and there are writers credited to it. They're kind of, you know, doing a story structure on it. And there's also sort of a side story about these antelopes, about how the female antelopes have to wander off to the river and do this long trek in order to give birth. And you see the cranes flying in and out to denote the passing of the seasons. And it's a pretty good film there.
Is it in 3D?
It is. Well, I saw it was in 3D. I'm not sure if there's a 3D edition
available.
The last
one of these I saw was in 3D.
I know it's on the IMAX screen in a couple of theaters here in town, but it is gorgeous. The photography, as usual, is just beautiful. They do a lot of time-lapse photography to show the passing of time, and that's put to good use. But what really is interesting is they're letting things play out. I will say one of the stories doesn't have an uplifting, happy conclusion. So you would think that since these films are geared towards the youngsters, they're sort of selling them to the kids. Oh, look at the cute pandas. Well, you're going to get a little taste of how nature really is, and it's tough at times. Mm-hmm. There's actually the monkeys, that turns out there's, I think they call it the goshawk, preys on the monkeys, and at one point it swoops in and grabs an almost newborn, and you know, there's no rescue there. But that's not the story I was referring to. So I will give kudos to the producers for leaving in some of the tough stuff that happens in real life.
All right, and you reviewed Born in China for WeirdMovieGeeks.com. How many stars did you give it?
I want to say I gave it 3.5, something like that. And some of the narration gets a little cutesy at times. They have a tendency to want to anthropomorphize, I guess, the animals, and give them real human qualities. Oh, you know, telling you what they're feeling. Well, you can't really tell what they're thinking, right, or their feeling, or their emotions are. But it's a really well done film, and it's gorgeous to look at. And stick around for the end credits, because they show you how the photographers, the directors, shot this thing, which is really interesting too.
Okay, so Jim recommends Born in China. Let's move along. I saw Phoenix Forgotten.
I believe that the flying saucers are objects from another planet.
The Navy has no saucer-shaped aircraft or missile.
There's no good reason for keeping this secret for three decades.
The government's been lying about UFOs for 50 years.
What is that?
Oh, okay.
Which premiered at number 11 with $2 million. This is a new found footage horror movie.
Oh, brother.
With sort of a science fiction twist. It's about these lights that were flying over Phoenix, Arizona in the mid-90s, which really did happen. And then these three high school students, two boys and a girl, decide to make a documentary, or decide to document their search to find out exactly what was causing these lights. And then they disappear. Then 20 years later, the sister of one of these boys who had disappeared 20 years earlier is making a documentary trying to find out what happened to her brother and his two friends. So what you've sort of got is two sort of documentaries. They keep cutting back and forth between the footage shot by these teenagers 20 years ago and then this documentary by this woman who's now, you know, in her 30s. You can tell the different styles because the 20-year documentary is shot on sort of a low-tech camcorder, and then the new footage looks a lot sharper. There was some footage that they found, and it doesn't really tell them a whole lot. They found the teenager's car parked out in the desert over there in Arizona, and there were a few clues. Well, about maybe halfway through the movie, this sister who's making this documentary happens upon a new tape that nobody had ever seen before, and this is actually the final leg of the journey of these teenagers. It's a little convoluted how they found this tape.
Well, it sounds a lot like that Blair Witch reboot from last year or the year before.
It is. It's kind of the same plot, because in that the documentary filmmaker was trying to find out what happened to his brother, and this plays out a lot like Blair Witch Project. So the last 25 minutes of the movie, Phoenix Forgotten, is this footage that they found. And that plays out like a 25-minute condensed version of the Blair Witch Project. I mean, everything about it is the same dynamics. You've got two boys and a girl, and they're lost out in the desert instead of the woods, and they keep looping around and finding things that they had found earlier, and they start getting hysterical. And then there's lights and screaming, and the camera's shaking, and then the camera drops, and then the movie's over. But then they never go back to the newer footage with the sister. I mean, once they show you this missing 25 minutes, it sort of ends there. I sort of had high hopes for this movie. Ridley Scott is credited as a producer on
really?
It, and you'd think with him attaching his name to this, it would have been a little bit better, but it's really not. It's just more of the same. It's PG-13, I guess, because these kids say a few bad words here and there. But there's really no violence in it. There's not much excitement. The shaky cam sort of made me nauseous, as some of these movies tend to do.
Yeah, glad I missed it. That gets to me every time.
Yeah, I really can't recommend this movie, Phoenix Forgotten. Unfortunately, I thought it was going to have potential, but it just turned out to be more the same. I did not review it because I didn't see it. They didn't show it to us. In fact, not only did they not show it to us, I was going to see it Thursday night, but they didn't even have any Thursday night screenings.
Really? That's very odd for a film like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I guess they were afraid of bad reviews. But I looked at the tomato meter like yesterday, and it was at 50% with about, 10 or 12 reviews. So some people, are liking this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was really let down and disappointed by it. If I were to have reviewed it at the Weird Movie Geeks, I might have given it maybe 2 out of 5. That would have been generous. So I do not recommend Phoenix Forgotten.
Well, you talk about Ridley Scott having his name on this. I think Martin Scorsese has his name on Free Fire. So
Free Fire.
And all kinds of great actors in that.
We reviewed that last week. Yeah, that was pretty lame. In fact, that was one of the
pretty
worst
puzzling
movies I've seen this year.
Yeah,
I was saying to Jim, is there a single line of dialogue in that movie that doesn't have the F word in it?
Probably not.
I'd like to see the script.
Yeah, I think Brie Larson got away with a few F bombs,
that's another Phoenix Forgotten is a terrible title, but Free Fire is an even worse title because I can never think of the name of it.
Yeah. Firefall.
My wife's like, I'm going to go to the movies.
Freefall.
What are you going to see? I don't know. You don't know the name of it.
Bunch of guys
look it up.
Oh,
Free Fire.
Each other. Yeah,
they would say Firefight or Free Fight or something. Anyways, we're getting off on a tangent here. Let's move along and review another new movie. You guys both saw The Promise.
It's very dangerous for Armenians right now. I want to get you out of here.
If it's not safe for me, then it's not safe for any of my people.
What is the Associated Press doing in reporting on the war?
Well, I should say something that I've been trying to avoid. I finally went to the wrong theater for the screenings. So I saw the second hour of Promise, which I've heard is the best hour of it. I don't know.
Well, actually, it's not bad at the beginning, but it has this.
Oscar Isaac and Christian Bale, and it's a World War I set adventure.
And French actress Charlotte LeBon. It's very pretty. It's set in World War I.
The prettiest of wars.
Pretty costumes. And it starts before the war, and it takes place in what is present-day Turkey, then the Ottoman Empire. And it's this young Armenian man who's a pharmacist. He goes to medical school in Constantinople, and funding his medical school is a dowry from a woman that he's in an arranged engagement with. Oh. You know, he just met her, but she has a wealthy father, and they have lots of money, and they're funding his medical school. So he goes to medical school from his little bitty village to exciting Constantinople, where he meets a beautiful Armenian woman who was raised in Paris called Anna, who's played by Charlotte Le Bon.
Who is she?
Well, we saw her in The Walk. Yep. And most recently in, Anthropoid, that was it?
She's in a number of French films, too. Yes. But she is the girlfriend of this American journalist who's played by Christian Bale. So there's this kind of sort of a love triangle there, but then he also made this promise to this woman back in his village. And while they're working out their romantic difficulties, World War I breaks out. Uh-huh. And what happens, what's the backdrop for this story, is the Armenian genocide, which was covered up for years and people didn't talk about, and more people are talking about it now around the anniversary of that event. And the film starts out pretty well, and of course the war breaks everything apart, and the Ottoman government starts rounding up the Armenians and taking them out. They're ethnically cleansing the villages, but actually they're driving them off into the woods where they shoot them, or they walk them into the desert and leave them with no food and water, that sort of thing. But they're denying that this is happening, and that's where the journalist comes in. But then the story kind of sags once the war starts, and then it picks up again towards the end when these people are trying to escape all this mess. So it's very pretty, and it has that first-rate cast, but it's not a real neat and tidy story, and you learn less about the Armenian genocide than you think you're going to.
Well, I would assume, Maura, you didn't have to suffer, Kate, through the Ottoman lieutenant a couple months ago.
I heard that was bad.
That was really atrocious, and that was really trying to cover it up. Mm-hmm. But they did vaguely touch on it. But, the last half I saw, this had some powerful imagery in there, and a nice little rescue. There's a cameo from Jean Reno as a the French are actually the heroes of this film, or one of the heroes of it. And James Cromwell shows up as the American ambassador, and he's got a nice, juicy scene. Right. But from what I saw, like I say, I didn't see the start of the romance, so I can't comment about that.
Now, the acting's fine, and it looks beautiful. It was shot in Spain and Malta. It's just, it doesn't have the dramatic drive that the story needs, and you don't learn as much about the history as you
Did you review this for WeirdMovieGeeks.com, Kate?
I did.
How many stars out of five did you give?
I think I gave it 3.5, which is probably a little generous.
And I understand that a lot of Turkish trolls are out there posting bad reviews to different sites of it.
Right, because
it,
the Turkish government still denies that this even took place. And actually, in the film, there's a scene where the American journalist is talking to a official of the Ottoman government, and he says, what war? There's no war here. What are you talking about?
All right, so Jim and Kate sort of liked The Promise, but they both thought it could have been better. Moving on, Kate saw Tommy's Honor about golf. Is it as good as Billy Madison, Kate?
So gentlemen pay you to play golf?
Hundreds of pounds, like.
What will you play for now, Tommy?
Money? Glory? Love.
It's a very different kind of story.
That's
this
no Caddyshack, though.
No. And this is, about the origin of the modern game of golf. It's a biopic about a working class Scottish father and son who pretty much were the founders of the modern game of golf and helped popularize it outside of Scotland in the mid-19th century. Prior to that, it had been a game just played by Scottish aristocrats, and these two working class people, this father and son, changed that. He was like an innovator of golf, in which he had designed courses and invented clubs and did all kinds of things. And his son, Tommy Jr., was the Tiger Woods of his day that made the sport popular. People wanted to watch golf because this guy was so good.
Was he married to a supermodel?
No, but he was married to a beautiful woman in this story. So there's a personal story, there's a family story. It's a real must-see for golf fans, but even if you don't care about golf, this is an intriguing, dramatic story, both the family story, the thing about the class divide, because these guys get a lot of pushback because they're working-class people in this aristocratic game, and it's set in the middle of the 19th century, And it's beautiful. Shot in Scotland. The cast is almost entirely Scottish, and it's directed by Sean Connery's son, Jason Connery.
Star of Operation Kid Brother.
Yeah, well, beautiful Scottish landscape.
That was his brother.
That was his brother. Yeah. What was his name?
Oh, gosh. Jason? Yeah.
So even if you don't care about golf, this is worth checking out if you like historic films, because of the beautiful scenery, the Scottish cast, and Sam Neill has a part as an aristocrat.
Did you review that for WeMovieGeeks.com, and if so, how many stars did you give it?
4.
All right, woo! Kate likes Tommy's Honor. Mm-hmm. All right, move on. We still got a bunch of movies to review, so I'm going to move along here. How about Their Finest?
The thing about men who get sent away to war is that some of them don't come back at all.
There's so many of us. They'll never get us all out.
Mrs. Cole?
Cut!
Where is she?
Could someone please get Mr. Hilliard out of Dunkirk?
We both saw that.
Okay.
Jim, you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, I think it's very charming. It's set around 1940 in Britain during the height of the war, and the Ministry of Information is putting out these short subjects to play in between double features at theaters, and people are bored with them. And they're
little propaganda films, so they're not exciting to begin with. Yeah, they have a purpose.
But people are actually deriding them and making fun of them. And they end up hiring a young woman who's from, she's Welsh. Played by Gemma Arterton, because she's written a couple of comic strips, propaganda comic strips. And they want to cobble together a feature based on the recent Dunkirk military operation, and about a story of a couple of sisters that tried to rescue some of the soldiers.
And she's initially hired just to write the woman's dialogue, which the lead script writer calls the slot.
The slot,
and that's played by Sam Claflin,
who we know from the Hunger Games films. And it's all set in that time period. They're dealing with the bombings. They're having to run down to the subway. But the interesting, I guess, the B plot is Bill Nighy as a great British actor who's kind of vain. I think his name is Hilliard.
Yeah, past his prime.
He's past his prime. He had started. It's referred to that he had started as a police commissioner in a series of B movies, but he's getting a lot of work, but it's only because all the main actors are drafted, and they want him for this new movie to play sort of the comic relief, the drunken uncle, and he thinks it's kind of a downward spiral for his career. And his story is very interesting, especially the dealing with his agents and his agent's sister, which is kind
Eddie
Morrison at first, and then his sister takes over for him. And it's a great period piece. The costuming is wonderful, and I think we both enjoyed how they try to recreate Technicolor. They decide to go all out with this Dunkirk film and actually produce it in color. And the way they sort of reimagine that or restage that is very interesting. And they're so concerned about this film, they even bring in an American, a real American war hero, to sort of help get the Americans interested in the war and get them into it. And one of your favorite actors, Tom, Jake Lacy, plays this character. I saw him in the credits. I was like, well, what's he doing in this? And he's very entertaining.
Something that was interesting about this film is it's more about the behind the scenes of filmmaking in this area, and in this era, and particularly script writing. So that's something you don't usually see. And it's both funny and romantic and tragic, because they deal with real things that happened.
And you reviewed it for Weird Movie Geek. Kate, how many stars did you give it?
I think I gave this one 4 stars, too.
Oh, good. Sounds like it'd be a good movie to watch before Chris Nolan's Dunkirk.
And plot goes in different directions than you expect, so it's not... Yeah. Not what you think going in.
And, of course, they take the real story and dress gussy it up quite a bit. That's very funny, too.
Yeah, that's
all right, so Jim and Kate really liked Their Finest.
Yeah.
I saw Colossal.
You ever notice how it just keeps destroying everything in its path, but it never looks down? It's like it's being operated by remote control.
Colossal's being held over a second week over at the Tivoli, so I went and saw it Saturday night. Colossal stars Anne Hathaway, Oscar winner Anne Hathaway, and she plays this woman named Gloria, and she's introduced living in New York City with her British boyfriend, played by Dan Stevens, but she's a mess and a drunk, and he finally kicks her out of their apartment and breaks up with her, so she moves back to her home town where she grew up, and she moves into her parents have died, and she's moved into the house that she grew up in. And she hooks up. They don't identify where, even what state this little small town is, but I guess it doesn't really matter. She hooks up with a childhood friend played by Jason Sudeikis, who owns a bar, and he gives her a job in the bar as a waitress. And then you've got a couple of characters, Tim Blake Nelson and Austin Stoll, who played Gary Francis Powers in that Spielberg movie last year. They're like the two regulars at the bar. So it's sort of this character story about going back to your hometown and et cetera. But it's not really, because on the other side of the world, there's a giant monster stomping through Korea. And everybody is transfixed to their television sets. They can't believe that there's this giant monster in Korea, and it's like the big story in the world. And at some point, Gloria realizes that what she is doing, the monster is doing. She scratches her head, the monster scratches her head. But only at a certain time of the day, and only in a certain park near the house where she grew up. It's not always. So if she steps into this park, the monster materializes in Korea. And then if she dances around, the monster dances around. And it takes a while for her to realize what's going on, so she stops, like, killing people. She feels kind of bad about it. And then at some point, Jason Sudeikis realizes that he can do the same thing. So he shows up at the park, and there's a second monster. It's actually a robot. So these two have this sort of love-hate relationship anyway. So they're always fighting. So they're slapping each other around. So you've got these two monsters in Korea that are slapping each other around. It sounds sort of interesting, but it's not. It's not a very good movie. I was kind of disappointed with it. What it does, it sort of introduces this sort of, meta, Charlie Kaufman-esque concept. But it doesn't really do anything clever with that. What it really is a story of, all these characters living in this small town. It's sort of like, Elizabethtown or Garden State or something like that. I wish it had gone in a totally different direction than it did, because these characters aren't particularly interesting, especially Jason Sudeikis. I think he's kind of a lightweight TV sitcom type of actor, and he's not very good in this. And he's not very, his character's not very interesting. Tim Blake Nelson and Austin Stoll, they're not very interesting either. I will say that there is a good performance at the center of this film by Miss Anne Hathaway. She's pretty good, but I just didn't like where the movie went. I didn't think it was very interesting. And it lasts, an entire 110 minutes. So it's sort of a one-note gimmick that's stretched to an almost 2 hours long. And it just, in my opinion, it just doesn't work. Some people might like this movie, but I didn't think it was particularly well-written or all that interesting.
Well, how's the Kaiju stuff in it? Is that well done?
It's not really, because it's shot, it's all at nighttime. Mm. She has to be in this garden at 8:05 a.m., which is like 12 hours earlier than, right. Or 12 hours later maybe than what's going on in Korea. So it all takes place at night. So it's real dark. I think they didn't have much of a budget for the giant monster stuff, so
it's
sort of abstract.
Suit,
what's that?
Is a guy in a suit pretty much?
It's a guy in it. Well, no, it's probably CGI, actually. Oh,
okay.
It's probably
okay.
CGI. They just didn't have a big budget for that kind of stuff. And that's not really important to the story that be particularly good. I don't know if that being better would have made the movie any better. It's just that I just didn't think the story was particularly interesting. It's directed by a guy named Nacho Vigalondo. Maybe it's the best movie made by a guy whose first name is Nacho. I don't know. But he did an interesting time travel movie a few years ago called Time Crimes, which I saw at SLIFF. That was pretty clever. Hmm. And I was hoping this one would be a little more clever like that. But it's not. It's just this character study of these young people and their various lives and messed up lives and relationships. And I wish it had been something different. But it wasn't. So I didn't particularly like Colossal. Some other people might like it, though. It's gotten some pretty good reviews. But had I reviewed it at WeAreMovieGeeks.com, I would have given it a measly 2 stars.
Yeah, kudos to Hathaway for kind of going out on a limb there and for something unusual after getting her Oscar.
Yeah, sure. I guess. Yeah, and she's good, like I say. She's very good, but the movie's not particularly good. I was pretty bored with it. All right, let's move along. There's other movies to review. How about Cézanne et moi?
Yeah, Cézanne et moi.
That means Cézanne and me, by the way.
Or Cézanne and I, as I've seen it translated elsewhere. Okay, so that's a...
this sounds like some kind of highbrow French movie.
Well, it is French, yes. And it's actually very beautiful. It's a kind of a biopic about the lifelong friendship, kind of love-hate friendship between post-impressionist painter Paul Cézanne and the novelist Émile Zola. And I'm not sure why it's not called Cézanne and Zola, because it's not particularly from Zola's point of view. And in fact, it probably spends more time with Cézanne's character. It's beautifully photographed. It's brilliantly acted.
Who plays these?
And it's meticulously researched. I don't have the...
Both actors are named Guillaume, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Both named Guillaume. Guillaume Canet is kind of a fairly well-known British actor, and he is the one who plays Zola. The other actor, I haven't seen him before. He's from Comédie Française, as are a number of people in this film, and actually the guy playing Cézanne is the real standout in the acting, but all the acting is good. It's more about their personal lives than their careers, and it makes a lot of assumptions about what the audience knows about these people's work and careers and the time period. So I'm sure that works well in France, but it makes it kind of challenging for a lot of American audiences who are going to see this.
Is it a long film?
It's a two-hour film, which is long for a European film. It focuses more on their relationships and personal lives. So although it's a wonderful film, it's really better for people who are big fans of Cézanne or Zola and really know a lot about them, more than somebody who's coming in to think they're going to learn something because it's going to be somewhat over their heads. However, I recommend everybody stay for the montage at the end of the film that runs behind the credits, where they do a montage of Cézanne's paintings of this particular mountain in the south of France. And it's just beautiful the way they transition the paintings one after another. Mm-hmm. And that's a real treat. You get to see very little of his paintings in the film, although you get little snippets of Zola's writing. But pretty much it's about their personal lives.
Hmm. Okay. So how many stars did you give it?
I think I gave it 4, it kind of will depend on the audience. You know, for the audience knows a lot about
four-star reviews last week.
There were some good movies.
All right, well, very good. All right, let's move along. Jim saw Unforgettable. When I saw the trailer for Unforgettable, I just thought it looked so stale. It looked like a trailer for a movie that might have come out like 15 years ago.
Oh, well, I know.
Beginning with Katherine Heigl. Is she a thing? I thought she was sort of unofficially blackballed.
Tessa said that she found Lily talking to some guy.
What guy?
She seemed to think that you knew him.
Who was the man you were talking to at the market?
What man? I'm scared.
You're not getting off this horse. Come on, Lily. I'm sorry. Who asked you? We're leaving.
Well, this is kind of this movie
is her comeback or something.
Well, it's kind of capitalizing on her reputation as she's got a rep as being difficult. When I see her, I think about Knocked Up, the film.
Yeah, that was the one that put her on the map.
Yeah. Yeah, and then she was out bad mouthing it after it came out about her character.
And she did a bunch of rom coms.
Oh, awful rom coms. Yeah. And and then she's had a couple of failed TV shows. But this is speaking of TV, this is more of a Lifetime movie. A super Lifetime movie with a terrific cast and an interesting director. This is a first feature film from Denise DeNova, who I know mostly as a producer, mainly on Tim Burton's films for Warner Brothers. And here she's decided to go in with, as you're talking about this seeing 15 years old, I may be more than that, because it harkens back to Fatal Attraction quite a bit,
it looks
too.
Like a Fatal Attraction.
And The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, or one of those type of films. Rosario Dawson is the hero in it. We first meet her. She's all bruised and bloodied. Oh, she's wonderful. She's in all the Netflix Marvel series as a nurse, and she's terrific in that. And she does what she can with this material. It opens up with her being interrogated by the police over a horrendous crime, and then it goes back 6 months to her leaving San Francisco for an unnamed Southern California town, the same kind of town that's always in these unnamed town in these made-for-TV movies, because she's going to live with her fiancé, David, played by Jeff Stoltz, and everything seems to be fine there. He's got a cute little 8 or 9 year old girl, but the ex-wife is there in town. That is Tessa, played by Katherine Heigl, and she is a sort of a parody of maybe a little parody of the Gwyneth Paltrow perfect, homemaker mom, a little bit of Martha Stewart thrown in, and there's a lot of tension between them, but they're both trying to be agreeable to each other, and then things get amped up when we find out a little bit about Rosario Dawson's past. her character's name is Julia, and it turns out she was in an abusive relationship several years ago, and the fellow that got put away for it is about to get out of jail, and now the restraining order is going to be lifted, and there's a lot about assuming identities. Tessa at one point opens up a Facebook account for Julia because Julia's doesn't have Twitter or Facebook or anything like that, so you got that element thrown in, and there's a big confrontation to them, and you're thinking, well, this is kind of nice that you have these two actresses, they're the main leads in this film, but they're fighting over a guy, so it's kind of a step backward.
This movie sounds great, Jim. Is it?
No. It's
lame.
It's cheesy, and it's got a camp quality. I forgot to mention Tessa's mother figures into it there, and she is played by Cheryl Ladd. So we get a Charlie's Angel in there too.
Well, there was a Poison Ivy. She was in that. So it sounds a little bit like that.
Yes.
Now it's rated R. Why is it rated R?
Well, there's a few F bombs in there. At one point, Tessa has some sort of angry revenge sex with a waiter at this restaurant in the parking lot, which is kind of out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And you see Rosario's bare backside at one point, and there's a little bit of blood, a little bit of cursing in it. But I will say that the ending is so howlingly campy and awful that it's almost worth the nonsense up to it. It's kind of like that movie a couple of years ago, the Boy Next Door that we saw, Tom.
Oh, that's
kind of fun. It's nearly as much fun as that.
Not nearly as much, but
like I say, it's a good kind of forgettable movie unforgettable is kind of forgettable, I should say.
So you did not review it, but you're thinking about reviewing it.
Yeah, I think I might review that.
How many
tonight?
Stars are you going to give it, maybe?
Oh, I might give it 1.5 or 2,
All right, so Jim thinks Unforgettable is forgettable and lame, but apparently it's not the worst movie ever made.
Oh, no.
All right, we are done reviewing movies. Yay for us.
You're happy in your work, Johnny.
Buy the lift.